Jai Prabhu Nityananda Shri Rupa Dana Shri Rasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki
Jai
Shri Shri Hare Krishna Gaura Gopinath Shyama Kunda Hare Kunda Giri Gaura Dhan Ki
Jai
Vrindavan Dham Ki
Jai
Jura Dham Ki Jai Madri Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai Jagamay Juna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Sarasti Mahani Ki Jai Samaveda Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaura Premananda
Hare Krishna
All glories to the assembled devotees All glories to the assembled devotees All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru Nandaranga. All glories to Sri Kapara. Shri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Hiti Namini Namaste Sri 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 Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Nityananda Kamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Rupam Sai Vajatam Sahagana Vedana Pramitam Samshadivam Sarvaitam Sarvajitam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Vare Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishatam Vitamashtra Vanchika Puchi Vishatam Vishatam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya April 22nd, 2018, Mahila, Hawaii, and we're going to be looking at Judd Barrett's story of the Forest of Enjoyment, and then we're going to go from there to the Srimana Shiksha Raghunath Das Goswami, including some of the instructions that Lord Chaitanya gave to Sanatana Goswami, particularly about the fortune teller Sarvagya. So, alright, so we're going to start off with Judd Barrett's story. So all of you know that Judd Barrett didn't talk to anybody. He acted like he was deaf and dumb. And he went his whole life without speaking. People didn't even know if he could see. And then and he went through a whole lot in his life also, from his stepbrothers and from the dacoits who were going to kill him. And for some reason, who knows why, somehow, when he was carrying the palanquin of King Rahugana, and Rahugana got angry with him, somehow or other, Judd Barrett decided at that time that he was going to speak. Why he decided he was going to speak then, or he hadn't spoken before, I don't know. Not explained. But he started to speak, and he told King Rahugana a story, a metaphorical story. So it starts out with the fact that the soul has decided to rebel against the Lord and enter into the material world, which is compared to a great forest. And in this forest, the living entity is compared to a merchant who's trying to get money by gathering things from the forest, by gathering different products from the forest and selling them at a profit in the villages and in the cities. Now, the problem is that as the soul is traveling in this forest of enjoyment, and Prabhupada titles the chapter The Forest of Enjoyment, later he refers to it as the forest of material enjoyment. He titles it the forest of enjoyment. So we're getting different things. If you think about a forest as trees, and the trees have, you know, some of them give fruit, some of them give seeds, some of them are going to give resin or bark, different kinds of things according to our particular taste, how we want to enjoy the world. And we're thinking, this is my forest, this is my world. You know, here I am, this is my world, I'm going to gather the things of this world, and I'm going to make a profit here, and I'm going to enjoy. Of course, we're not thinking that the forest doesn't belong to us, right? It's kind of like if I came here and I looked around and I said, oh, that's a nice bench, I could sell that and make some money. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Oh, I can make profit off this and I can make profit off that. So with these kind of desires, the soul transmigrates from one species to another, to another, to another. Wandering, as Mahaprabhu says, wandering, right? Within this forest of so-called enjoyment in one species after another, after another, after another. Now, sometimes the fortunate soul meets a saintly person, which Judd Barrett compares to a honeybee. The saintly persons are like honeybees, and this is an illustration from the book, by the way. You're asking if there's illustrations from the book. actually, this is also an illustration from the book, as is this one. And this is from the cover of the book. So, meeting a saintly person who's like a honeybee. And why is the saintly person compared to a honeybee? Because the bee knows how to extract the essence or the nectar of a flower, and the essential nectar or essence of life. So this is in contrast to the wandering conditioned soul who's looking very externally and looking at how can I enjoy the world, how can I make a profit out of the world. And the honeybee is instead saying, how can I find the essence of the world? And again, the saintly person is compared to a honeybee because the honeybee goes for that which is sweet. Usually the comparison is to a fly, which goes to that which is a sore or a nasty thing. So when the conditioned soul meets this honeybee-like saintly person, then the saintly person starts instructing us about how to see the world instead of as a place for enjoyment and for profit, for what it really is. Now, it's not exactly that the world in general, I mean, I know Krishna says, Dukkhalayam Shashvatam, this is a place of suffering. But the world is only a place of suffering to one who sees the world as a place for them to make a profit. So if I come to this place and I start looking around at all the things here as if they were mine and I were going to make a profit off of them, then being here would become a place of suffering because none of you would like me and you'd call the police and so many things. Right? But if I come here with the mood that the place belongs to someone and I'm in harmony with the owner of the place, then it's no longer a place of suffering. So the saintly honeybee-like person explains how when we have this mood of a merchant in a forest, that everything becomes a place of suffering. And Jed Bard is going to go through a number of analogies to show us how, although we think we're the enjoyers here, it's actually miserable. So one of his analogies has to do with mosquitoes and flies. Right? And there's that saying, right, if you think one person can't make a difference in the world, try sleeping with a mosquito. So, you know, we've all had this experience that one mosquito in the room, and you're like hitting your face, right? You wake me up all night hitting yourself, and you turn on the light, and you try to find the thing, and you can't find it. So these mosquitoes and gadflies, this is a metaphor for envious and critical people. So I'm sure any of us who've lived long enough, any of us who are older than, you know, like 12 or 13, we've had this kind of problem in our life. We've had people who are envious, who are critical, and often they're critical when we're trying to do something nice for them, or when even we're trying to do the right thing. You know, we're trying to do the moral, ethical thing, or we're trying to serve them, we're trying to make them happy, and somehow all they can do is criticize us. And sometimes this criticism and this envy is so intense that it's hard for us even to sleep. And sometimes, just like when you're trying to sleep with a mosquito and your mind is, you're so absorbed with this, but you can't think of anything else. And often it's like that with envious people. You know, that your mind starts going and going and going. How can I deal with them? What can I say? What can I do? What can I do? And how can I deal with that? Then he gives another metaphor of rats, locusts, and birds of prey. So this is the metaphor that we have hard-earned wealth. We've worked really hard for something, and it just gets taken away. And I'm sure we've experienced this too. And this we start experiencing as soon as we have a brother or sister. You know, you only have to be about like 2 or 3 years old to experience this one. So, you know, you build your little castle out of blocks, right? And you're taking a lot of time, you're building your Lego castle, whatever, and your sibling just comes and rams it all down. Right? And this happens throughout. We work hard on something. You know, even I've been in situations where I was asked, you know, can you please get this project done? Can you do this? And I've spent months working on it. And then some other person, another even devotee, just got, oh, it's not it. This is no good. Forget. We're just going to have someone else do it. Forget it. You know, you're like, whoa. So this is, you know, you've planted your crops. You're ready to harvest your crops, just about to harvest them. And then the swarm of locusts comes in. And it's just gone. you know, it's just, everything is just gone. You work for it, you work for it, you work for it. I mean, this happens even in relationships. You know, we put a lot of time and energy into a relationship, and then something just gone. Just over. You know, everything that we've invested. Now, this is a really interesting one about hunger and thirst. And we find, like, even great devotees such as Maharaj Pariksit shows us that when he was hungry, thirsty, and tired, he ended up insulting Shamaka Rishi, right? And we've all had this experience, either we've done it or someone's done it to us. Somebody's in a bad mood and they dump it on us. Right? As a teacher, I always noticed, you know, if the kids were uncharacteristically naughty, they were probably hungry, tired, thirsty, or their parents had a fight that morning or something like that. And so they come to school and they dump it on the teacher.
They're hangry.
They're hangry, yeah, exactly. You know, and so many times a person has another issue going on in their life and we become their garbage can. You know, something else has gone on. They're hungry, they're sick, they're tired, they had a fight with somebody else, they've got financial problems or whatever, and they think, oh great, let me take it out on you. And we may do that to others as well. I was just today reading one devotee posted something on social media of a story from the scriptures of this hunter who comes and shoots an elephant and injures the elephant. And the elephant in its fury destroys the jungle. And then the elephant's mate says, now in your fury at being injured, you've destroyed your own home. And this is this kind of story about, you know, we'll destroy our own family. You know, the person who's abusive with their family members, if not criminally abusive, and cruel and heartless, even with those that they love, because something else is going on in their lives. And then sometimes we think, oh, now I will achieve my dreams and my goal. This is the castle in the sky. So we're thinking, you know, I'm going to make it big. Like I'm thinking, this book I'm publishing is going to sell millions of copies. I'll become famous and rich. So we, you know, we think like that. You know, I'm gonna break through somehow or other, and I'm gonna achieve my dreams, right? I'm gonna become, like, what's really funny to me is these guys who win the silver medal in the Olympics and then they don't accept it.
What?
I think that happened in the last Olympics. Somebody won the silver medal and they were so disgusted that it wasn't the gold medal that they just took it off. So we have these castles in the sky, you know, I'm gonna become rich, I'm gonna become famous, I'm going to become this, I'm going to become that, or I'm going to become, you know, a great Satan person or whatever. And we're just, this is what kind of keeps us going in our life, these mirages that are always ahead of us, always ahead of us, always ahead of us. And just like a mirage, we never actually achieve it. And another interesting metaphor is this phosphorescence, these lights in a marsh that appear to us similar to the castle in the sky, but it looks like there's some wealth, it looks like there'll be some profit, but when we get to it, we find it's something different than what we had imagined it to be. We invest time, we invest money, we invest energy in doing something, and when we actually get there, it's like, oh, it's not actually what I wanted. And I always tell the story of one of my professors who said that when he was 19, someone visited his class and said, if you follow this procedure step by step, you can become a school superintendent by the age of 33. Usually it takes like in your 50s before you become a school superintendent. So he said he followed that step by step, everything, and it happened. He became a school superintendent when he was 33. And then he found out he didn't like being a school superintendent. He hated it. His wife hated it so much she divorced him. And then he realized, I really just wanted to be a teacher. He became a college professor. So, you know, we search after these, it looks like something. You know, like Shakespeare said, all that glitters is not gold. You know, it looks like something. Oh, there's some gold up there. There's something that I want. There's something that I want. So the castle in the sky is something that looks wonderful that you never get. Our dreams of sense gratification, our dreams of material happiness, we never get them. The car we never get, the toy we never get, the marriage we never get, the job we never get, and then this one are the things that we get, and then it's like, why did I want that? Now this one is interesting. This is a shallow river filled with rocks. And this is like religions that promise material benefit. You know, it looks like a religion. So, you know, you've had all these frustrations in your life and you think, let me take to religion and religion will give me material prosperity. That will give me what I want. And we find this, you know, you have these religious leaders in the United States that'll say, you know, join my church, send me $5. Really, this really happens. I'm not making this up. Send me $5 and I'll send you a blessed handkerchief to put under your pillow that you'll become wealthy. You know, I'll send you the right Bible verses and you'll become. And this is in every religion. I mean, you know, take up a religion in order to short-circuit the material difficulties. And this is like a river that's full of rocks. It's shallow. It looks like a river, but when you jump in, you just crack your head open. You just get injured. And so you think, oh, you know, wow, this religion's going to make it for me. Religion's going to... And you become equally frustrated. And these religious leaders that promise this, generally they get involved in some scandal where they're really just, you know, like these people whose quick rich scheme is how to sell you their quick rich scheme. Right? So the way that these religionists are telling you you're going to become rich is by preaching a religion that you're going to become rich. And eventually it becomes revealed that they're taking all this money from their followers and they're buying, you know, their own private jet and so forth. Here's another metaphor, that of a whirlwind, a dust wind. This is another illustration from our book. And this whirlwind or dust storm is improper sexual attraction. So we find this is very common even among spiritually aspiring people, that will be, you know, some sort of lust, some sort of sexual attraction become so overwhelming that we lose our intelligence. We go for an improper partner, we go for an improper relationship, or something that's wrong in the relationship. We're just blinded. Like when you're in a dust, you just can't see clearly. And we might think, well, you know, that's only going to happen to someone else. But it happens to many of us, that we enter into some liaison that simply causes us distress. In the end, we say, why did I do this? Why did I get involved with this person? They seem so attractive. They seem like the perfect person. And we become bewildered. Okay, then we have some more enemies, the owls and the crickets. So like the mosquitoes, the crickets make some noise at night, but the owls are very silent, and the owls will come. These are night creatures. The owls silently kill their prey. So these are unseen enemies. So the crickets make noise, but you can't find them. And the owls, of course, are very silent, and they sneak up on their prey. So we have these kind of enemies too. We have the mosquitoes where we hear their criticism. We know about their criticism. We just can't do anything about it. And then we have these enemies where we know that someone criticizing us, we don't know who it is. This is like when someone comes to you and says, you know, I thought I should tell you that many people are saying that you've really got a problem with arrogance. Or you've really got, you know, you just can't get along with other people. It's this vague thing. And you're like, well, who's saying it? And what exactly are they saying? And how many people? Well, I can't tell you that. You know, it's in confidence. I can't let you know what it is. I mean, I had something years ago where these devotees came to me and they said, Urmila, you really need to support our whole mentor program that's going on here. And I'm like, okay.
What kind of program?
Mentor. And I said, okay. I support your mentor program. Fine. No, you don't understand, Urmila. You've really got to be supportive. What did I do? I obviously did something. Well, no, you didn't do anything. But we went, and it was this like posse that came. You know, really grave people that knocked on my door, you know. I said, I must have done. No, you didn't do anything. No, it wasn't any problem. But we really want to tell you, you've got to be more supportive of our mentor. It took me 2 hours to find out from them what I had done wrong. You know, it's like, so this is like these owls, you know, somebody's criticizing you. I've had these things on social media too, so somebody will write me a message. It says, Urmila, I want you to know that whatever other people are saying about you, I support you. And I'm like, great! I'm so glad to hear it. What exactly are people saying about me? One or two of those times I found that it was somebody else named Urmila. You know, like 2 weeks later, I found out it didn't. Anyway, so these are the unseen, you know, nebulous criticism. All right, then we have these kind of enemies. These are the enemies who actually hurt us. So we have the mosquitoes and gadflies who criticize us. Then we have the owls and the crickets who are behind our back. And then we have the enemies who actually hurt us. Now, they actually damage our reputation. They take our money. They mess up our life. They really do some kind of harm to us. So these are compared to the snakes who actually bite us. And now we have, Gopa Vrindapal is going to like this one. So here we have family ceremonies. So family ceremonies. So these are all the different, you know, all the different aspects of householder life. The birthday parties and the weddings and the funerals and the this and the that. That we spend, so you know, the time and the money and the effort and the exhaustion. Right, so I remember I wasn't here for that, but when Padmasri Arjuna had their big engagement ceremony here, then a few days later they flew to Detroit and they had a wedding there. Right, so my daughter was going like nonstop for about 3 or 4 weeks on like 3 hours of sleep. So I remember I was there in Detroit after the main wedding, and then you know the bride and groom went to the big Sadhu Sangha festival as that was their honeymoon. And the next day, my daughter was so tired that anytime she sat down, she would literally fall asleep. She could not sit. It took about 3 or 4 days before she could sit down without just keeling over. So these family ceremonies are compared to steep mountains that are covered with thorns. Thorns and pebbles. So it's like great difficulty, great expense, right? So there's, in many parts of the world, people will mortgage their house, second mortgage their house to put on a wedding, right?
Glad you mentioned my name.
Yes. So this is like, you know, this is the $25,000 wedding. Right? I attended one wedding where it was like, how did they spend $25,000 on the wedding? They said, well, the dinner alone was $10,000. I'm like, oh my God. $100,000. And then you have to enjoy it, right? After all that pressure. Reminded me, like, when I was a little kid and my mother would set something up and then she'd say, okay, everybody, now you have to be happy. All right, now we have taxation. So all of you anarchists and libertarians will like this one. So Jed Bard said that government taxation is, it's like the government is like cannibalistic demons who are eating the citizens by overly taxing them. So then we have the anger of the hive. So this is about particularly illicit sexual relationships. So if we have a relationship with someone else's spouse, someone else's boyfriend, girlfriend, then the bees who own the hive, they become angry and they attack us. So of course this is very common, becoming more and more common in modern society. Adulterous relationships, and then one becomes attacked by the bees, and one is simply suffering. And then we have the python of sleep. So when the python attacks someone, and particularly they stop the heart. So this is about not just ordinary sleep and sleeping too much, but our sleeping in illusion, where our heart becomes asleep to Krishna consciousness, where we live our lives in a sleeping condition. And then finally, if that wasn't bad enough, the lion of death. So, you know, all of this trouble, all of Dukkaliyam and Shashvatam, not only Dukkaliyam, not only all of these miseries, but the end, it's all temporary. At the end, it's all finished. All of our struggles finished by death. and again trying to start over. So this is the knowledge that the bee-like saintly person gives us of the nature of this world. So somebody who's a little intelligent will say, all right, let me get out of this. Let me get out of the mosquitoes and the pythons and the snakes and the crickets and the beehives and the all of these things. Let me go on and find something higher in life. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu tells this analogy to Sanatana Goswami. He says that there's a great treasure. Each of us has a great treasure, but we have to know where to find it. So he warns us that we can think we can find this treasure in ordinary religiosity. Now this is a little different from the shallow river of Jadbarat, where, you know, religions that just aim for gross sense gratification. But these are the religions that aim for higher bhakti and mukti. So religions that aim for heaven or for merging in the Brahman. And these desires for heaven or merging in the Brahman are compared to two witches. And we must say, honestly, that most religious teachers in the world are not teaching beyond this. They're teaching, become religious. Yes, you can find the essence of life. Go beyond ordinary suffering. Take to our religion. Follow our prophet and our holy book. And you'll go to heaven or you'll get salvation. So Mahaprabhu is saying, no, this is like two witches haunting you. They're bewildering you with a spell. And that's not where the essence is to be found. And of course, Raghunath Das Goswami tells us that we should love all of the teachers of religion, even those who are teaching ordinary varnashram, even those who are teaching ordinary things in the world. And if we love them, but without becoming enveloped by the spell of these witches, then we can go beyond ordinary religion. So going beyond ordinary religion, how are we going to come to this essence of life? Now, if we study especially the Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, we will find that there's four main ways of attaining this essence of life. And these four main ways are compared by Mahaprabhu to four areas in a city. So he says that the all-knowing Sarvajna says to the seeker of the essence of life, your treasure is buried somewhere. But if you look in the south, you're going to be attacked by hornets. If you look in the north, you'll be attacked by a snake. If you look in the west, you'll be attacked by the yakshas or the nature spirits. So look in the east. But of course, he's also told him that in the east, another place, he told him in the east, you have to be careful of a mad elephant. So let's first look in the north. In the north is what we would call the mastery connection, or Dhyan Yoga, also sometimes called Astanga Yoga. So of course, Dhyan Yoga is a bona fide means of yoga. It's given in the Bhagavad Gita in the, what chapter?
Six.
In the sixth chapter, end of the fifth, sixth chapter, also mentioned somewhere in the 18th chapter. And of course, Dhyan Yoga is explained in a number of places in the Bhagavatam. Lord Kapila talks about Dhyan Yoga. Dhruva Maharaj, to some extent, did Dhyan Yoga. There's many places in the Bhagavatam where personalities engage in this form of yoga, where you go into a trance, you withdraw your senses, you bring up the life air to the higher chakras, and so forth. So this mastery connection can give you the essence of life, if mixed with a little bhakti, of course. But the difficulty is that when you engage in this Dhyan Yoga, you will awaken a snake. And of course, that's one of the purposes of Dhyan Yoga, is in fact to awaken the snake. That's one of the purposes. But the snake can eat the yogi. And in fact, most of the Dhyan Yogis today want the snake to eat the yogi. They think it's a very good thing if the snake eats the yogi. They're thinking that we want to awaken this kundalini so as to lose ourselves. We want to merge. To lose ourselves. To merge into the Brahman, or to feel that we are one with the super soul, and in that way to get many powers. Just like in the 11th canto, it's explained that one can get all the mystic powers by certain types of meditation in the super soul. But the yogi who becomes distracted by these powers, or the yogi who ends up wanting to merge into the Brahman, it's like they become eaten by this. And it's interesting because for many of them, that's actually what they're desiring. But it becomes a distraction, it becomes a detour. And so these people don't end up finding the essence of life. All right, what about those who take up Gyan Yoga, or the knowing connection? So Gyan Yoga, one tries to find the essence of life through philosophy, through detachment, through studying the philosophy of the scriptures and trying to understand the world to achieve some connection. But here Mahaprabhu says, your problem are the yakshas. And who are these yakshas? The yakshas are nature spirits. The yakshas are, like we could say, the deities of the lakes and the rivers and the mountains. And they're the... Now, in Iceland, there's so much of a belief in nature spirits that they actually will change where they build roads and what they do in order to... Just like here, people are respectful of Pele. You know, so in Iceland, they call them, I think, the Hudu folk. So they're very respectful of these nature spirits. And these nature spirits are also called yakshas. And they're more powerful beings than regular humans, but they're not really like devas or even like upadevas. They're really beings that take care of nature. So what happens when you enter into Gyan Yoga is you're really studying nature. You're studying Sankhya Yoga. You're studying counting the material elements. But what happens when you study these things is you can become bewildered by nature. And you can lose the whole picture. See, these nature spirits, these yakshas, they're guarding the secrets of nature. They're keepers of the treasure. They belong to Kuvera, who keeps the treasure of the world. And those who study Gyan Yoga, they become confused. We see that many of these philosophers, they come up with a theory, and then they come up with another theory, and they come up with another theory, and another theory, and they never really see the whole picture. And they become enamored by all of their theories and all of their knowledge. And these yakshas prevent those who are trying to enter through Gyan from accessing the real essential treasure. Then we have Karma Yoga, or the action connection. And this is where one tries to, so where is Gyan Yoga discussed in the Bhagavad Gita?
Can you explain in Gyan Yoga why that relates to the nature spirits?
Yes, because in Gyan you're studying nature. You're studying philosophy, but you're studying like the relationship between the self, the mind, and the sense objects. So in Gyan Yoga, you're studying, do the sense objects exist in and of themselves, or do they only exist as my perception?
Yeah.
That's an element of Gyan. You know, what is the relationship between the seer and the seeing? How am I the observer? In Dhyan Yoga, so in meditation, you try to understand how you're the observer by mechanically changing the flow of the life air and the energy, which is done like, say, what's become very popular in modern meditation. In Gyan Yoga, you're trying to get that understanding of yourself as the observer and the essence of everything by understanding intellectually how everything relates to everything else. So if you think of the great philosophers of the world who try, what is the nature of reality? Is there some overarching essence of reality? Do we really each just have our own view of reality? Is your view of reality your truth and my reality my truth and there's no overwhelming reality? Does the world have an objective existence or is it only a subjective existence? What's the relationship between consciousness and mind? What is the relationship between mind and body, mind, body, and sense objects? So this is all called Sankhya, which is described in the Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter particularly. It's described extensively in the 2nd and 3rd canto of the Bhagavatam. Now, if you're just studying these things, the nature spirits, they're trying to prevent you from getting the treasures of nature. They're guarding those treasures of nature. So just like the snake distracts you from getting spiritual realization by dhyan, by offering you mystic powers. So the nature spirits also distract you from understanding God and the essence of life through nature by giving you all kinds of philosophies which somehow contradict each other. And we find that that's true in modern science and modern philosophy. One theory contradicts another theory, which contradicts another theory, and none of them are looking at the whole. And they never get that unified field theory where they get the whole. They always get it. I think of it like if you have a cloth with a pattern, so I don't really see any here that could be...
Here.
Okay, so if you're looking at the pattern there and Chandrika's cloth, so if you look at just a part of it, you wouldn't... You might say, okay, it's just yellow, or it's just green, or like the example of the six blind men and the elephant. So the nature spirits bewilder one so that you think you're seeing all of reality and you're only seeing it. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So now we come to karma yoga, or action connection. And what parts of the Bhagavad Gita deal with karma yoga?
Three and five,
particularly. And again, part of 18 deals with all of them. So karma yoga is where you take what you would normally do through karma, which is whatever your career is, whatever your varna is, wherever you are in the life cycle by ashram, and you, karma pala tyaga, you do the action but giving up the fruits of that action. And that way you develop detachment and get a sense of yourself as the observer. And you get a sense of yourself as different from the body. So the problem, one big problem with karma yoga is that it's based on karma. You have to know your karma, which most people in 2018 haven't a clue. You know, most people in 2018 are not in a proper ashram, and they're really confused about their varna. So if you don't get karma right, you can't do karma yoga. Now here, Mahaprabhu says, the problem are the hornets. Now, I did some research into this, and in Bengal, you have giant hornets. I mean, they're so big, you can't see it very clearly there, but in the upper right-hand corner, that hornet is on a finger. That what you see under that hornet, you see the kind of, like, peach-colored thing. I'll turn on this one second. So this thing here. That's the bottom of a finger. This is a fingernail. And this is like the first and second knuckle of a finger. So it gives you some idea of how large these hornets are. And by the way, hornets and bees... So hornets and bees are enemies. So these giant hornets will attack beehives and kill the bees and steal their honey. And bees can also kill hornets. If they come in a group, they can kill the hornets. So the hornets are the natural enemy of the honeybee, of the saintly person. Now, these hornets have a very strict hierarchy. And they have, they're also, how would you put this? They really have, they're not very nice. Between the males and the females are not very nice. So, in fact, the males are so cruel to the females that the females would prefer not to reproduce. They try to get away from those males. The females would prefer to just not have any eggs than to deal with the males because they're so intense. So this is, it's a really bad situation between the genders, and it's a really bad situation with the hierarchy among the hornets too. So the upper class hornets will attack the lower class hornets. It's like a perfect, you know, the feminists and the Marxists could really use hornet society as a good example of, you know, what not to do in the world.
Do they all live in the same nest and still...
Yeah, but they're not very nice to each other. Like when it's time to breed the female, the queen hornets, they'll like try to race away from the drones. And it's far out. So I was saying that what happens in karma or even karma yoga is you can get into a pride or an exploitation about your position. This is the downside of karma and even karma yoga. You know, I'm a brahmana, I'm a man, I'm a this, I'm a that, and you will tend to exploit those who are less powerful than you. Or, you know, this is the downside, that you start identifying with your position. You know, I did quite a bit of research and prayer as to why did Mahaprabhu pick these? Why did he say the snake is with the mastery connection? and the yakshas with the action connection and the hornets, the yakshas with the knowing connection and the hornets with the action connection. Okay, now of course Sarvagya doesn't talk about any problem with the devotion connection with bhakti yoga, but Mahaprabhu did talk about the wild elephant earlier on to Sanatan Goswami. So of course the devotion connection, which is what we've all dedicated ourselves to. So here we're trying to achieve the essence of life through love and devotion to a personal God, to Krishna. And here we have to watch out for the mad elephant. Now the mad elephant means the elephant in must. So bull elephants are, I think they're unique in the animal species in that the male goes through a period of heat. So in most species it's only the female who has some period of like this. Of course male elephants can breed at any time like most males, but they go into, and it's irregular when a male elephant, when a bull elephant will go into must. But when they go into must, they become really nuts. They just become really, really nuts. They have these physical symptoms. They're basically urinating constantly. So the inside of their back legs are covered with urine, and they have this thing called temperin that is pouring out of glands on their head. And the theory is that the constant urine and the constant temperin is bothering them. They become very sensitive to noise. The slightest noise will send them into a fury. And they also become very sensitive to anyone who they think is aggressive with them. And a bull elephant in must forgets any loving relationship it had with anybody. So an elephant in must will attack the mahout who trained them since infancy. Anyone who loved, elephants are generally very loving and caring creatures. They generally remember any love and affection that they've been given. They're very grateful creatures. They're very, very gentle, very grateful. But a bull elephant in must is just the opposite. They will attack and destroy and kill anyone. And anywhere they will just destroy a whole forest. And the theory is that the reasons that the elephants go into must is that generally only the older bulls will have mates. And that the only way that a young bull will ever breed is when they go into must, everybody gets out of their way. So the old bull's just like, we're not dealing with this guy. And they get out of their way, and then they're able to find a mate. And must can go on for weeks or months. So traditionally, what the mahouts would do is as soon as they notice the very first signs of must, they chain up the elephant and they starve it. They don't give the elephant practically any food or any water at all. Just bare minimum for life, and 2-3 days, the must is over. Nowadays, what they do with elephants who are like in circuses and stuff, they feel that it's cruel to withhold food and water for a few days. So instead, they put them in a cage. And remember, this must come on for months. So they just put them in a cage for months. The traditional mahouts feel that their way is more humane. And of course, this elephant in must represents Vaishnavapurat. So the biggest difficulty in the path of bhakti is that one starts thinking, yes, I'm a devotee, I'm advanced, I know something, and I'm better than the other devotees, and I can criticize them. And like the elephant in must, we will then turn on even the very people who are nourishing us, and the very people in our sangha, the people who are really our well-wishers, we will turn on them and we go crazy. And of course, the way to avoid this is as soon as even some offensive thought rears its head in our mind, which, if any of you are like me, that does happen. You know, Hare Krishna. I once tried to make a vow that I wouldn't criticize anybody for all of Kartik, and you know, all of a sudden I became aware of how critical I was, and it was absolutely shocking. So as soon as the critical thoughts come, as soon as they, you know, as soon as there's the slightest hint, you starve them. You starve them. You don't indulge them immediately. Don't give them any food. Don't give them any water. So let's say that we conquer these, we go to the devotion connection, and we don't feed this elephant as soon as he gets mad. So then we go to the instruction for the serious sadhaka. So we've gotten out of the forest of enjoyment, we've taken shelter of the honeybee, saintly person, we have found the eastern section or the devotion connection, we're not feeding our mad elephant. And now we're going to go for the instructions of Raghunath Das Goswami, the splendid instructions to the mind. And taking up this path of the devotion connection. So he tells us, start off is have love for Guru. Have love for Guru. And Bhaktivinoda comments, we should see Guru not only as a saintly person, but also as our dearest friend. And have unprecedented love, not love of this world, not the transactional love of this world, but actual giving love for Guru. And then have love for the holy name. Have love for our mantras, for our Gayatri mantras, for the holy name. Real love for the holy name. Not to take up the holy name as just some ritual or something mechanical, but really, Krishna's there in his name. Krishna's there in the mantra. To have great love for the holy places, and not only in India, but a holy place like this, for the holy place we set up in our own home, for all the sacred places, to love them, to care for them. And to have love for the process of surrender, even though the process of surrender is bashing and smashing and tearing apart our false ego. To love that smashing and bashing of our false ego, which is taking away everything that is keeping us from what we want. And Raghunath Das Goswami says, all right, you went through, you know, you go through all the obstacles of the world, the snakes and the flies and the mountains with thorns, but you still have to be careful of some obstacles on the path of bhakti. So the first is the obstacle of sound. That sound is what creates our life, it's what creates our future, what creates our bhakti. And to beware of improper sounds. He says, beware of mundane gossip. It may not be out and out Vaishnava parad, but mundane talk, mundane gossip, ordinary conversations of this world that are not necessary for our bhakti. He said, it's like a prostitute who may look attractive and may promise pleasure, but steals all of your wealth of bhakti. And he says, be careful of the talks of liberation. Oh, I can't wait till I die and leave this body.
Who says that?
Many people. I can't wait till I get out of here. When am I going to go back to Godhead and get out of this terrible place? So we should instead have thoughts of service. Otherwise, these talks of liberation, they'll be like a tigress that eats our very self. And the way that we get rid of these is to have a jewel of service. If we have a jewel of service, then you'll not become enamored by ordinary gramikata nor talks of liberation. And then what about our actions? So we may conquer sound, but in our actions, we may be talking nicely, but we may not act nicely. And this, Raghunath Das Goswami compares to thieves who capture us on the road of bhakti and put ropes around our neck. And these, of course, are lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, madness. And they have these ropes. These are the activities which we speak against. We know are wrong, but we do them anyway. These are the ways in which we don't live up to our own ideals. And what's happening is our lust, our anger, our greed is grabbing us by the rope and pulling us here and there. And of course, Arjuna asks about this in the third chapter. He said, why is it that I know what to do and I seem to be forced against my will to do something else anyway? Krishna says, this is your own lust. Now, the problem with this is that we think that these thieves are our friends. We take shelter of lust, kamashrita, ahankar ashrita. We actually think, if I do this thing, I'll become happy. You know, I eat this thing, I watch this thing, I do this thing, I'll become happy. So how do we get free of this? We get free of this by calling for help of the geckos, who then save us from lust. So here he comes to save us.
He's looking for something to eat.
He's going
to
take those ropes right away from me. Now, if we call for help from the saintly devotees, help, I'm being highwaymen are pulling me by the neck. So it's only the Sangha of devotees who can save us from these bad actions. first of all, by having these kind of sanghas where we're doing something nice instead of something bad. Also by the sangha, which will hold us to a standard of behavior, which we may not like all the time, but, you know, which will say, hey, what are you doing? Why aren't you doing the right thing? And devotees that we can confess to and say, hey, I'm having a problem with this, I'm having a problem with that. Help me out. Then we go to the problems Raghunathas Goswami is talking about, the mind, the gecko of the mind. So here is a kind of self-hypocrisy. So lust, anger, greed is hypocrisy to others. This is a kind of self-hypocrisy. So this is where we've already conquered lust, anger, envy, greed, but Raghunathas Goswami says, in the name of purification, we're actually bathing in donkey urine. So this is when we're doing the right thing, but for the wrong motives. I'm doing the activities of bhakti, I'm not doing anything sinful, but I'm doing them to get praise, or I'm doing them to get money, or I'm doing them to get a comfortable life. You know, there's something wrong with my motivation. And we know we're doing this when we feel a burning sensation, because this donkey urine is burning. When we're not satisfied, we're doing everything, you know, we're saying the right things, we don't have the problem of speech, we don't have the problem of action, but somehow our heart's not satisfied, Krishna's just not manifesting in our heart, and this is when our motives are wrong. And he says the cure for this is a bath in the ocean of love. Now what does that mean? It means surrendering our mind to Krishna, to Radha and Krishna particularly. This is the ocean of love at the feet of Radha and Krishna. And we ask them, please reveal my motives to me. Please reveal to me what's actually in my heart. Please purify my heart. Then we come to the difficulty, Raghunathas Goswami takes us to the difficulty in the heart. So after we've conquered this, after we've conquered having proper speech, having proper actions, having proper mentality, then we still have to deal with our deepest desire, which he compares to a dead dog. And not only a dead dog, but an unchaste dancing woman in the heart who wants to eat this dead dog. So she is compared to the desire to be honored for one's purity. The dead dog is honor, and the dancing improper woman, unfaithful woman, is compared to the desire to be honored for one's bhakti. And her lover, Bhakti Vinod says, is deceit. So this is where we want to appear to be a saintly person, so other people will say, oh, what a saintly person. So we've come through the whole forest of material enjoyment, we went to the devotion connection, we're not feeding that mad elephant, you know, we're speaking Krishna Katha, we're not doing anything sinful, we don't even have ill motives for what we're doing, and we're thinking, we're bathing in the ocean of love, we're thinking, I'm so pure and everybody should know it. Come see how pure I am, bathing in the ocean of love. And Bhaktivinoda said this desire for honor is the root of all of our anarthas. So how do we get rid of this? We have to serve the saintly persons, especially the generals in Mahaprabhu's army. Not just even the saintly persons, but the great generals. Oh, and when we do that, then we are lifted out of this desire for honor. And the reason is very simple, is because when we serve the great generals in Mahaprabhu's army, then we take the position of a servant instead of a saintly person ourselves. Let me serve the saints. Instead of this, I want to be a great saint, it becomes, let me serve those who are great saints. And then we come to actual humility. We see that everything we have is due to mercy. We no longer think that we're some great person. We see that I'm very dirty, and by the mercy of the saint, some flower can grow, even though I am so fallen. And the great ocean will cover up, will become like just a puddle, and I will cross over all of this difficulty, like the demigod saying in the beginning of the 10th canto. The great ocean, the great ocean of my faults will become like a small puddle. And then I can have total absorption. I can have total absorption in the holy name. I can have total absorption in the Lord, his name, form, qualities, and pastimes. At this point of total absorption, I can actually enter into Vrindavan. This is another picture from the book. I can enter into Vrindavan which the literal translation, by the way, Vrinda is the sacred fragrance, and Vana is, of course, forest or garden, so the garden of sacred fragrance. And then in this total absorption, I will see Vrindavan for what it is. I will see Vrindavan as the abode of the Lord, and I will realize my swarup, I will realize my true identity in the Lord's service. I will realize who I am, what is my service, who do I serve in the spiritual world, everything about my real identity. And then I may continue to act in this world. I may continue to look like an ordinary person in this world, but actually, inwardly, I've been transformed into my own identity. I'm living like in two worlds. So internally living in the spiritual world, externally acting in the world. And then I will actually drink this real nectar or essence of life. As it said in the end of the Bhagavad Gita, I will live life with a thrill, not just once, but at every moment. So I hope you enjoyed this travel through Chad Bharat's forest of enjoyment, and through the different quarters of the city at Sarvagya that Mahaprabhu told to Sanatana Goswami, and then going through the journey of Manashiksha to come finally. And then this is